Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
2020, let's do that year.
We functionally had a mean tax of 37%, not 90% as that high part of the marginal tax rate. But we're getting 9.2% of the economy.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
Most people have no idea what I'm talking about when I say, but here's the economy. Here's a really high marginal tax rate. We have a history of this, and repeatedly you're only getting about 7% of the economy in taxes. We lowered the marginal tax rate for these top brackets, and now we're getting over 9%. We get dramatically more because the economy got bigger. And you show this to our brothers and sisters on the left, and they'll often say, yeah, I know it, but it doesn't feel like I'm punishing people. And the amazing irony, do you know the highest income Americans vote for Democrats, not Republicans? It's just, it's the bizarreness.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The greatest country, the greatest nation the world has ever known, the wealthiest nation the world has ever known, has been totally irresponsible in the way she has spent her money.
Last week on the floor of the House of Representatives, Mike Kelly, a representative from Pennsylvania.
And it wasn't done by her. This incredible group of people that sit down here. And remember, I said this to begin with. I don't believe anybody should serve in public office until they've been in the private sector. I myself have been in situations on the 6th of the month and the 21st of the month where I made sure every person that worked at the dealership got paid. There were many times I did not pay myself because I didn't have enough money to do it. And the point I think we keep trying to make is that when are we going to wake up to what is going on? This is a Titanic moment for our country. And the reason I say that is because the Titanic went full speed ahead into an iceberg. And what did the captain of the Titanic see? Just a small part of the iceberg was hidden up. They didn't see what was hidden. My friends, right now, the hidden part of what it is that we're spending, and I would just ask you to please think with us as we go through this. Reduce it down to where it makes sense and understand what is happening right now on the floor of this Congress. We represent you. We do not represent ourselves alone. We represent you. In my district, PA 16, the average income for a family of four, mom, dad, two children, is $54,000. And this is because this is where it really starts to make sense. Federal revenues this year are going to be the highest we've ever got. They're projected to be $5 trillion. That's a lot of money. I mean, it's almost incomprehensible. Now, what we're projected to spend is $6.9 trillion. You say, well, that's not that far apart. It's only $1.9 trillion. Here's what it means. And please, I really, this is where it starts to sink in. That means a family that I represent in Western Pennsylvania earning about $50,000 a year is spending $69,000 a year. So you see what we're getting to? You see where it is? Because when you reduce the numbers down, first of all, the high numbers are just so high, it's unimaginable. It's also unimaginable that we can ever pay the debt down. But I will just say this to you. If we continue on the path we are going, if we disregard the basic math that stands there and the way we do it, and most of us, I can tell you, most of the time when I pay monthly bills, it is at our kitchen table, and I open my checkbook, and I start doing the addition, subtract. And I'm just trying to understand how we can be so reckless. None of you would do this because you have too much respect for your children and grandchildren's future, and you also have too much respect for yourselves. Nobody would consciously do this. That's the problem. And that's the problem. One of my favorite movies, and I think this is what I just want to make a point, called A Few Good Men. So have you seen this movie? Jack Nicholson's in it, and he's being cross-examined in a military trial. And they keep asking him questions, and at the end he becomes so frustrated, he says, you can't handle the truth. In our lives, the people who raised us, our moms, our dads, our grandparents, would never have done to us what we are happening right now, and we're doing to our own grandchildren. We have to handle the truth. We have to face the truth. And David, this path that we're on, and this mission that we're on, and this idea that somehow we have to get the message out to our hardworking American taxpayers. Our future is being destroyed because of irresponsible spending. Now, just to be sure on this, your Social Security will never be touched. Medicare, Medicaid is not going to be touched. And the banks are never going to forgive us the interest on our loans, okay? That's the reality of it. So when you understand it that way, it becomes, oh my gosh, what are we going to do?
Pennsylvania Representative Mike Kelly. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
And what is critical about baseline for a farm bill is that under the statute, under the federal budget statutes, CBO is required to assume the bill as it currently is written, does not change for 10 years into the future. And then they model all of this expected spending under that statutory outlet or that statutory scheme, assuming no changes.
Former administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency, now a farm policy expert, Jonathan Kappas.
So we're looking at roughly $120 to up to $130 billion a year. So in a 10-year budget window, that will come out as a $1.3 trillion price tag. But again, remember, that's 10 years. That's not $1 trillion every year going out the door.
Kappas, now with the University of Illinois, says raising revenues, not an option.
What is critical about this? As anybody that's dealt with recent farm bills knows, the baseline is the budget the committees have to work with. And under budget rules, they are required to stay within this baseline. And so any changes to statute will be scored by the Congressional Budget Office, and those changes have to be offset. So that means you have to cut other programs to offset increased spending. It used to mean you could raise revenue if you needed to. The House has implemented new rules this year, this Congress, that would require cuts, so you cannot increase revenues in any way, shape, or form. So this really creates a zero-sum political game under the baseline. What happens if you want to spend more money on Title I payments? Well, under the rules, you're going to have to cut something else. You're going to have to cut within the jurisdiction of the committee, and that means you're going to have to likely look at either SNAP, crop insurance, or conservation as a source of offsets. And of course, the politics of that are, well, rather challenging.
There is a unique aspect of the 2018 Farm Bill.
The other item that makes the 2018 Farm Bill experience very unusual, very unique, and certainly adds some uncertainties around what this Farm Bill debate looks like. So in August of 2022, Congress passed through budget reconciliation procedures, which allows them to bypass some of the rules such as the Senate's filibuster and 60-vote threshold requirements that really can bog down legislation. But it means it passed on a party-line basis, and it was signed into law in August. It was a massive bill with funding all across different areas. There's a lot of focus on climate, healthcare, and some tax policy changes. But tucked within this is something very important for the Farm Bill. And that was what you see on the screen before you. So for fiscal years 2022 through 2025, the Inflation Reduction Act appropriated large additional amounts of funding for EQIP, for CSP, for the easement program, and the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. The total appropriation was exceeded $18 billion over this time frame. This is not baseline funding. This was a separate appropriation. So we have these programs. They have permanent funding through the Commodity Credit Corporation. That's in the solid bars there below the programmatic levels. That is baseline. The Inflation Reduction Act provided this additional appropriation. It's a multi-year appropriation. The authority extends through 2031, so they have time to spend it, but it is not a baseline change. And so CBO will not be considering that in the Farm Bill baseline for 2023 looking forward, which means it also is not part of that baseline negotiation and calculation in the same way. So I want to be clear that this additional funding exists on top of or in addition to the baseline funds in a farm bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, the King Ranch Institute for Ranch Management was created when the King Ranch turned 150 years old back in 2003.
Dr. Clay Mathis, named director of the King Ranch Institute for Ranch Management 13 years ago.
And the family saw a challenge that the skill set it took to manage ranches in the future was going to be different than the skill set that was needed in the decades or century ahead. And so the King Ranch Institute for Ranch Management was created to train master's students through a Master's of Science in Ranch Management program, and our graduate students have ranch management experience after a bachelor's degree. And so we take that experience and add to that a really strong skill set in business management and leadership. And the result is we have graduate students that, although there's only 48 of them, they manage over 7 million acres across 15 states in the United States now. But we also have an outreach program, which includes our symposium. And we also do some applied research here at the Institute as well.
Mathis says one key component for the future is sustainability.
Sustainable ranching, it's kind of a topic that makes some of us excited and some of us a little bit uncomfortable. You know, when we think about sustainability and ranching sustainability, from our industry's perspective, we've always thought that way. Success in ranching was being able to pass the ranch on to the next generation, being a profitable business that could sustain those generations to come, and at the same time, improve the land, take good care of the livestock and the wildlife. And so that's who we've always been. But in the last decade or so, it seems like as an industry, we're faced with having to prove it just a little bit more to the rest of the world. And we created this symposium to certainly identify what are some of the challenges with to sustainability and what we face in ranching today. But what was really mostly behind what we were doing to create this symposium was finding those opportunities that this creates. We have an opportunity to tell the good works that we've done in this industry, and we need to be better at that. It's not who we are culturally to brag on ourselves, but there's things that we can do that can make us better. And so we've created this symposium to educate those that are interested in what's really the state of the discussion and sustainability from a ranching perspective. How do we measure that? And then how do we get better and market that sustainability as well?
But why is sustainability important for the industry?
You know, when we think about economically or in environmentally sound, we think about greenhouse gases. We think about water runoff and rangelands that are in good condition. We think about the efficiencies of a lot of the practices that we do and how they can contribute to improving our environment. And when we do that, we gain more social acceptance in those practices. And when we gain more social acceptance, that leads to more consumer trust, which affects the price, whether it's for beef or lamb products from these ranches, or it's some of those recreational opportunities. But we have to have consumer trust in what we do so that we can generate the revenue to become economically viable or to improve economic viability. So those are all interrelated, and we have to see those as one system, not just as independent pillars.
Mathis stepping down from the King Ranch Institute of Ranch Management. He'll be the new Department Head of Animal Science at Texas A&M. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
NEPA kind of looms large over everything in the federal grazing space.
Sigrid Johannes is Director of Government Affairs with the Public Lands Council.
So it stands for the National Environmental Policy Act. And this is a landmark piece of legislation that is more than 50 years old at this point that sort of lays out a framework and a process for federal decision making, particularly as it pertains to environmental impact. So when federal agencies like the BLM or Forest Service are contemplating a project or an action on federal lands, they have to go through NEPA analysis to determine what the environmental impacts are going to be. And another key aspect of NEPA is that it's intended to make some of that analysis and make some of that information public for the sake of transparency. What are the kind of, you know, environmental impacts and environmental factors that the American public can expect from a given federal project? That's kind of the intent. Now, where we've ended up since then is over the past 50 years, environmental activists and pretty radical groups that are anti-agriculture, anti-energy, they are generally opposed to a lot of the industries that keep our nation moving forward here, have used NEPA as a very effective tool to shut down some of those federal projects. So there are kind of two levels of NEPA analysis. When a federal agency first begins this process, they might go the route of doing an environmental assessment, which is a little less onerous and a little less burdensome. Or they might say, no, we've got to do a full EIS, a full environmental impact statement, which is a kind of higher and stricter level of scrutiny and higher stricter level of analysis. What environmental activist groups will often do is sue on process. They'll sue saying you missed this step. They'll sue on a whole variety of fairly frivolous factors to either push federal agencies to do that higher route of analysis, take that longer path out of the two options, or to just stop the progress of the analysis entirely and kind of keep the agencies tied up in court so that these simple projects can't move forward. And when I say simple projects, Tony, the reason we're so caught up on this and kind of the whole reason that we're down in the weeds on NEPA is because for a federal land rancher, NEPA applies to a whole host of things that can really slow them down. It's everything from, you know, installing fence, making, you know, basic range improvements on their grazing allotment, like putting in fence, installing water lines, cleaning ponds and reservoirs, all of these kinds of basic maintenance activities that you wouldn't think about twice on your private, you know, operation on a private land ranch. If you're out on your grazing allotment, they're subject to NEPA, and so they're a frequent target for some of those activist groups.
So do the activist environmentalists actually protect the environment?
In many cases, the action that gets prevented or blocked or held up by some of these, you know, frivolous lawsuits are in fact beneficial, or they have a clear sort of ecosystem service benefit to the range where ranchers are out operating. The other thing that I think is difficult in the current system to account for, and something that we've asked for more clarity on in our comments that we just submitted during this comment period, is that there's a cost to inaction too. There's an environmental cost when the federal government fails to act on something. So it's not just what you're doing, it's also what you're not doing. And a big case where that comes up is wildfire. You know, when you fail to act to thin fuels and do really active, you know, chemical and mechanical thinning of forests or doing prescribed burns, things like that, when you fail to act, that risk of fire goes up. And the damage to the environment and the emission of carbon in those fires also goes up. So something that we've also asked for in this process is, you know, hey, as a federal agency, you have to honestly evaluate the impact of what you might do. But in that set of proposals, those what we said, the alternatives, the set of alternatives that the agency will lay out in their analysis, you also have to analyze what happens if we do nothing. Because a lot of environmental groups will say, well, the best thing you can do is nothing. And that's not always the case.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
And for me, one of the most interesting features in the livestock market is that we are in the contraction phase of the cattle cycle.
USDA Chief Economist Dr. Seth Meyer earlier this year on projections for cattle.
So the cattle cycle tends to ebb and flow because while it has a long-term direction of the U.S. herd shrinking, you know, these are animals with long biological lags. Okay, so a decision made today isn't a stake until 25 or 26. Okay, so decisions made today about retaining heifers, breeding them, and taking it through the system isn't a stake until 25 or 26. So when you look at this, we have folks where, yes, cattle prices are very good, but Western drought makes them uncertain, and high feed prices make them uncertain about expansion. When my colleagues in NASH reported on the cattle report in January, didn't see a turn. Didn't see a turn in terms of producers feeling confident they could retain heifers and make that turn. It will be important to understand this year whether they feel that confidence or not. I think drought will continue to play a role on those cattle features. But remember, even if we turn the herd in the next year, cattle, beef production is likely to fall through 25 or 26. And I think that that's different than we'll see in broilers and hogs, where when you look through the outlooks, you'll see an expansion in broilers and hogs. So you've got an overall a little bit less meat production in 2023 because the cattle shrink is so large it outweighs the increase in hogs and broilers. So when you're looking at this, you're saying I'm producing just a little bit less meat, but meat demand has been incredibly strong for the last several years in the U.S. It's been really one of the features is good demand strength within the livestock, within the meat market amongst consumers. And I think that, you know, as we sprinkled some of the risks into each of these markets, the one that I think is a risk for meat producers, so cattle, poultry, pork producers, is consumers' response. Are consumers going to stay in the market and continue to buy and demand meat? Is the meat demand going to remain robust? Or are there other features of economics that will push them to making maybe some cutting demand a little bit, or demand may weaken? I think that that's probably one of the key features for markets in meat in the coming years. Okay, as we see perhaps consumer personal savings rates have now kind of started to turn back up a little bit in the last few observations, maybe we can continue to see good demand for meat. But to me, that's one of the key features that's important.
What were the projections for other aspects of livestock?
Egg prices, That's a big percent decrease into 2023, still bigger than we've seen in previous years. And one thing that I think that we've got a whole section discussing some of the disease pressures. And what I will tell you is when you look at our baseline, this does not assume, for instance, a HPAI outbreak of a large scale that perhaps we saw this spring. It doesn't assume that. Okay? They'll talk to you more about that. It's more of a normal, these assumptions are always kind of a normal year. All right? So when you look at that, you have a retreat in egg prices. There'll be a much further detailed discussion on those in the livestock section. Dairy product prices, again, narrowing margins for producers here. So they were supported in 2022 with high product prices resulting in high milk prices. And given high feed prices, those two things work together to have producers have a pretty good year. As product prices fall in 2023, feed prices will fall too. But you're talking about a pretty good decline in the overall milk price, perhaps narrowing margins for dairy producers in 23.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We will discuss with China its performance under the Phase 1 agreement.
Ambassador Catherine Tai at the U.S. Trade Representative's office 2 years ago.
China made commitments that benefit certain American industries, including agriculture, that we must enforce.
After 2 years, though, still not much happening on the U.S.-Chinese front.
We continue to have serious concerns with China's state-centered and non-market trade practices that were not addressed in the Phase 1 deal. As we work to enforce the terms of Phase 1, we will raise these broader policy concerns with Beijing.
Though Phase 1 did help ag, it didn't lift ag back to where it should be.
U.S. agriculture has not been spared either. While we have seen more exports to China in recent years, market share is shrinking, and agriculture remains an unpredictable sector for U.S. farmers and ranchers who have come to rely heavily on this market. China's regulatory authorities continue to deploy measures that limit or threaten the market access for our producers and their bottom line.
And a recurring issue with China.
We also see troubling dynamics playing out today with the semiconductor industry. In 2014, China issued an industrial plan to announce the goal of establishing a world-leading semiconductor industry by 2030. Reportedly, China has already spent at least $150 billion on this effort, with more on the way. Its intentions are clear, just as they were with steel and solar. These policies have reinforced a zero-sum dynamic in the world economy where China's growth and prosperity come at the expense of workers and economic opportunity here in the U.S. and other market-based democratic economies. And that is why we need to take a new, holistic, and pragmatic approach in our relationship with China that can actually further our strategic and economic objectives for the near term and the long term.
So if we're not sitting at the trade table with the Chinese, what can we be doing? Tai says,
as our economic relationship with China evolves, so too must our tactics to defend our interests. As the years go by, the stakes keep getting higher, and boosting American competitiveness becomes all the more important. Our strategy must address these concerns while also being flexible and agile to confront future challenges from China that may arise. So how do we accomplish this? Unlike the past, this administration will engage from a position of strength because we are investing in our workers and our infrastructure. Repairing our roads and bridges, modernizing our ports, and delivering expanded broadband are the kinds of investments that will begin to give American workers and businesses the boost needed to embrace their global competitiveness. And we must harness and leverage the talent of our people by investing in education and worker training, investments that are included in the President's Build Back Better plan. We also need to redouble our own efforts to be the most innovative country in the world by researching, developing, and creating new and emerging technology. China and other countries have been investing in their infrastructure for decades. If we are going to compete in the global market, we need to make equal or greater investments.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Among the delegation of USDA's recent agricultural trade mission to Chile, representatives from various state departments of agriculture. What are their thoughts about the potential of future and increased sales of their farm and food goods to the South American market?
This has been a great opportunity to really work on the relationships, our rapport, and build a better understanding and appreciation for the Chilean culture, but also areas in where we can complement each other, given the fact that our growing seasons are opposite of each other.
Seeing opportunities for us and for our Colorado producers, especially beef, dairy, beverages, consumer-facing products that we see in the opportunities here, but also what we can take home and see complementary from our Chilean partners as well.
North Dakota Ag Commissioner Doug Goring and Colorado Ag Commissioner Kate Greenberg, respectively. 11 state Ag Department and Commission representatives participated in the Chilean Ag Trade Mission. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.